8:15 having arrived, I'll call the Education Finance Committee to order. And members, before we get started, I received my newspaper, my Pioneer Press this morning.
Uh-oh.
And the headlines here, Olympic takedown.
Yeah.
Now, as a former wrestling coach, the International Olympic Committee voted yesterday to, in 2020, eliminate wrestling. Wrestling! Now, this was the sport that was there, you know, the Greeks and the Romans, one of the original, traditional, ancient sports. And what really, Representative Detmer, Representative McNamer, I know they're also wrestling coaches, and we used to have Representative Heidgerken, Representative Haas,
Biskins.
And Representative Biskins. We used to, I mentioned Detmer, so I don't know how many more, but we used to kind of talk a lot about wrestling. But let me give you the reason here.
Don't forget, this is kind of symbolic
of who else do
the
we?
Former governor. Ventura.
Oh, yeah.
Not wrestling.
The governor notwithstanding, the reason, and I know we have some basketball coaches around here and those type of things, but here it said it wants to modernize the sport by drawing younger viewers among the international television audience. So, you know, forget the, you know, dedication and the hard work and the sacrifice. You know, if it's not exciting for television, let's put this sport away. I mean, no, really, that is, you know, we've got a nutrition bill today. Representative Newton?
Yes.
You know, people have been eating pretty much since the beginning of time. But, it's not that interesting to watch on television. People eat. Maybe we should eliminate, eating and funding for eating because it's just not going to make a good TV program. Unbelievable. So I don't know if there's a vote. But, I mean, when you really think about that, you know, where they have gone and you look at some of the sports they have added that are totally kind of commercialized sports. And so, no, I had not seen that or heard that last night, and I woke up and... So,
Mr. Chair,
we're
right here.
Representative Morgan.
I think they're cutting wrestling to pay back the swimming and diving shift.
Then let's get that paid immediately. So, anyway, that is very disconcerting, let me tell you. So, we'll see. So, you'll have to talk to Representative Detmer and Representative McNamer about this also today. All right, with that, we do have a quorum. Thank you for your indulgence, members, and we have minutes for February 12, 2013. Do I hear a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Representative Myra, thank you. Moves the February 12, 2013 minutes. Any discussion on those? If not, we have a motion to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Okay. Also, before we get going... there is an agenda in your packet on the February 19th night meeting I had mentioned yesterday. Education, finance, and education policy, the world's best workforce. There is the agenda. And also, just for your schedules, we will then not be meeting the morning of February 20th. So we will not be meeting that day. All right. With that, we have a couple bills, and then presentation from the Department of Education. So, Representative Newton, if you would like to proceed and move your bill, if you would.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 31 for possible inclusion in the K-12 omnibus finance bill.
Very good. Proceed.
And
with the
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask also if it would be appropriate for me to do an author's amendment since we have the fiscal note to enter the amount on this bill, or should we leave that until we do the omnibus bill?
Who's the motion?
Okay, we will leave that blank.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mr. Chair and members, I, about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, I attended a meeting with teachers from several school districts, St. Francis, Anoka Hennepin, Osseo, Brooklyn Center, and a couple others. And as part of the discussion, they started talking about the lunch issue with kids being denied lunch. And it was primarily kids on reduced lunch who would come in and didn't have their money for lunch. And some of the horror stories were that the lunch ladies would take the lunch off their trays, not let them eat. Others were that some of the middle school kids would come in, and if they didn't have the money, they would be brought to the back of the kitchen, given a container of milk and a cheese sandwich, and coming out to eat. And there was sort of a stigma associated with that, so the kids would refuse to eat. They just wouldn't have lunch. So I revived a bill that I had started in 2010 to provide that the children who are currently on reduced lunch would have the same benefits of children on free lunch. In other words, they wouldn't have to pay for their school lunch. We all know that children who are hungry don't learn well. That's one of the important parts of education. I always tell you, get a good breakfast, make sure you eat well. And another phenomenon, I don't know in your districts, but in my district, Anoka Hennepin, all five of our high schools now have food shelves, and the majority of our seven middle schools have food shelves. So that we have, you know, an understanding among kids in the school that some of their fellow students are going hungry, and some of their families are hungry, and those food shelves are very actively used after school by the kids who bring food home to their families. I think that we're the most affluent nation in the world, and we should never ever have a situation where any child goes hungry, regardless of family income, or kids don't choose their families, and we do have some parents who are rather negligent at times. So what this bill does is it raises the state aid for reduced price lunch by 40 cents. The total amount is roughly, I think you all have the fiscal note, it's about $3,545,000 a year that it would be increased. And with that, I have some experts. I have Jessica Webster and others who would like to testify, and I know we have an amendment for the bill also. So should we have the testifiers first and then do the amendment, Mr. Chair?
That's great. Yeah, Representative Newton will have the testifiers first. And,
good.
And
thank you, Mr. Yep. Chair.
Welcome. If you would identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. And just to lay a little bit more groundwork for this bill, we had talked to Representative Newton about this bill, I think, so 4 or 5 years ago when we found out about this alternative meal, this cheese sandwich, this peanut butter sandwich. Legal Aid was really disturbed about it. And then what we found out actually was the cheese sandwich was a good thing because children were being turned away with nothing. And so for 5 years, we've been coming up to the legislature and talking to legislators about children being turned away with nothing. And frankly, people just haven't believed us. Legislators just have not believed us that this is a problem or that any lunchroom staffer would turn a child away with nothing or would scrape a lunch into the trash. So what we did about a year and a half ago is we partnered with four private law firms in Minneapolis and had them survey about half of the state school district, a few hundred school districts, to find out what are their policies when a reduced-price child or a low-income child turns up to the counter and doesn't have money for lunch. What we found is about 20% of school districts do have a policy of turning a child away, and it looks different in different school districts. Some days it's you can run a debt of a week, or you can run a debt of 3 days of cheese sandwiches, and then you're cut off. And we're talking about elementary school children and middle school and high school. So, and there are school districts that will turn a child away on day one, including elementary school kids. We're talking 8-year-olds. So this survey project that I've summarized it, the packet you have in front of you is shows who we identified as having turn away policies kind of on that back page. And some of these, this was a year and a half ago, I think some of these have possibly changed. I saw that Brooklyn Center has possibly changed their policy. And the other thing I'll say about this research is it showed up, it turned up some really ugly practices that I don't think anybody in this room would necessarily agree with in terms of using shaming practices or deterrence practices to stop children from showing up without money. So sending them to the back of the kitchen to get a brown bag cheese sandwich and then have them walk by all of their friends knowing that that will embarrass the child and that they won't do that again. Issuing purple tickets, red tickets, making children wear rubber bands around their hands, stamping hands. Stamping hands is very common, stamping your hand with a money sign. And it's not a big deal for middle class and upper middle class children, but if you're always the child in rural Minnesota that has the money stamp on your hand, it's very stigmatizing. So the last thing that I'll say about this bill is, Minnesota Public Radio did a story last week, and in the end of that story, they identified two different school nutritionists. One school nutritionist was from St. James, one was from Brooklyn Center. Both school nutritionists described these unbearable pressures coming down on the lunch program, that they have to feed all these children, there are new mandates. And the nutritionist from St. James said, listen, there's these unbearable pressures. I have to be in the black. And so, yes, we turned children away. We turned away two children last year. And then you had the nutritionist from Brooklyn Center who said, yes, we have unbearable pressures. I need to be in the black, but I would rather lose my job than turn a child away. So it's not even always district by district. Sometimes it's school by school. Sometimes it's lunch lady by lunch lady or principal by principal that they're making these decisions. And it's not fair to put the school nutritionist or the lunch staff in the middle of this. We know of lunch staffers who are reaching into their own pockets to pay for some of these kids who can't afford lunch. So we support this bill. We think this is a good thing to do to support these kids that really can't afford this copay for lunch. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Webster, just, I don't know if this question is
to
for Ms.
Webster.
Yes, okay, if you would stay.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. And thank you for your interesting information here. I have a couple school districts that do have a turnaway policy, but the school board has made that decision. And so to what extent did you find that school boards are making these decisions based on information that they have available to them about some of the families who are not paying their bills?
Ms. Webster.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, it is a district by district level decision on this. And it's not always the school board making this decision. Sometimes it's the principal at a school making this decision. Sometimes it's sometimes it's the principal in conjunction with a PTA. Can the PTA do an angel account for these kids? So that it's not always a board level decision on this. It differs from school district to school district. One of the things that concerned us a few years ago and still concerns us is that school districts use debt collectors on these families to collect school lunch debts. And when we got serious about this legislation, we realized you can't get rid of the debt collection practices because that's how schools are chasing parents for these funds. So we did remove the debt collection practice from the bill that I think Representative Mariani carried in the past. And so school districts can use debt collectors on these families for these debts.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But just a comment. My boards have said that they have information that tells them that these parents need to be held accountable. And so, they're holding them accountable. And I think, that's local decision making. And I respect that. I think they have found some other ways to handle this. But at the same time, I respect my school boards and information they have.
Mr. Chair, I respect Representative Erickson. I just one comment on that. This policy of turning away children, it is holding parents accountable, but in a perverse way, because we're turning the child away for the action of the parent. I mean, it's almost a contract between the school district and the parent, and the 8-year-old that's in front of you is the one that's being held accountable, not necessarily the parent. That's why we're here.
Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Newton and you for being here today and bringing forward this important issue. And I just want to state that I could not agree with your position more. And I think that there are other ways to hold recalcitrant adults accountable other than denying their children food or having that stigma of having the rest of the kids laugh at you because you have to have the cheese sandwich or wear the rubber band. So I just want to state my firm support for this bill, and thank you for bringing it forward.
I think what we'll do, we have others to ask questions. I think we'll listen to the testifiers and then kind of remember who you might have a question for, and we'll call others up. So Representative Newton, do you have other testimony?
Yes, I have Allison Bradford, who's the school nutritionist for, not, she's a district nutritionist for an Okanagan school district.
Okay.
And remember, as you know, there aren't three of us on this committee anymore, but that it, we are the largest school district in the state.
Ms. Bradford, please proceed.
Hi, I'm Allison Bradford, the Child Nutrition Program Director for Anoka Hennepin School District. Thank you for having me here today. The Anoka Hennepin Child Nutrition Program is a fiscally responsible program serving approximately 5.5 million nutritious lunch and breakfast meals per school year. 35% of our students qualify for free and reduced meals. Approximately 430,000 reduced price lunch meals are served per school year at a price of 40 cents per meal. On average, 77% of our students qualifying for reduced price meals participate in the program every school day, which is a pretty high percentage. This bill would help support the 23% of our students who aren't participating participate, and also help the families of the children who are participating pay their bills because they do have difficulty paying the 40 cents each day. So we are looking for support of this bill to help those families in our district. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I understand there are some others who would like to testify on behalf of the bill. I don't know them.
Okay.
But I've been informed that they would like to testify. So
okay. Very good. We have a Mr. Chu.
He's on his way.
Okay. Is there a Dr. Cutts?
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. I am Dr. Diana Cutts. I'm a pediatrician. And for the last 20 years, my practice has been based at Hennepin County Medical Center. At the hospital, I'm involved in clinical care, and my clinical interest is children who are not gaining weight. I run what we used to call a failure to thrive clinic. I teach residents and medical students, and I do research. My research is on childhood hunger. And when I first started doing research, we called it childhood hunger. Currently, the term that we use is food insecurity. Why have we made the change? Well, childhood hunger is really an experience, a physiologic experience, which is very hard to measure. But food insecurity is something that we can ask questions about and measure. And the USDA has put together a food security scale which is used in the national census, and we measure food insecurity across the nation every year. At Hennepin County Medical Center, we've been using this scale in our pediatric clinic for 15 years, as we are the site, with my research collaborators, of a project called Children's Health Watch, which monitors young children's health and the impact of public policy on their health. So we've been looking at food insecurity in the patient population, which I see, for over 15 years. And I want to share with you a little bit about what I've learned as a pediatrician about the kids who I'm serving at HCMC. One of the things I've learned is that at our Midwestern site, we have the highest rate of food insecurity of any of the other sites. And let me tell you, the other sites are Boston, Baltimore, Little Rock, and Philadelphia. Our highest rates are here in Minnesota. Our rates vary between about 30-some percent and 40-some percent over the past 15 years. And with the recession, as expected, the rate has increased. What else can I tell you? I can tell you that the diagnosis of food insecurity is not a visual diagnosis, that I can't tell by looking at a child that they are living in a food insecure household, and I can't tell by plotting a child on a growth chart that they're living in a food insecure household. Children may be thin, they may be overweight, and most of them are normal weight. But I can also tell you that food insecurity harms children. And as our studies have shown, that we see increased rates of hospitalizations, we see poorer general health, we see even in the very youngest children a greater risk of developmental delay, we see increased anemia. And that's just our own research. Others have shown increased headaches and stomach aches, more school absences, decreased academic performance, more behavioral problems. One mom told us, I get mean when I'm hungry. What does that mean for parenting? What does that mean for her child? We see increased trade-offs, and this is something that I'm going to come back to, that in households which are food insecure, they are constantly juggling housing insecurity, child care costs, transportation, education. So none of this is news to teachers and schools. This is old stuff to them. Let me also say I'm the parent of four children, all of whom either attended or currently attend public schools in Minnesota since kindergarten. So I'm very familiar with the school setting and have attended my share of teacher conferences and orientations and parent nights. What have I seen and what do we know happens in the schools? Well, I see teachers who purchase out of their own pocket food because they know their classroom is going to go more smoothly if they feed kids. I see the schools conducting wonderful awareness and programmatic contributions to the effort to alleviate hunger in the Empty Bowls program, in food shelves which have been created in schools, as you alluded to, in backpack programs, which give children who identified as being in need a backpack full of food to take home so that they'll have food over the weekend. So this isn't news to schools. They know this is important, not just to an individual child, but to a classroom and to a culture of a school. So let me speak specifically to this bill, which I think at its essence says, yes, we recognize that hunger exists in children, and we have a great school lunch program. But we have a category of children who have existed in this reduced payment zone that we have drawn certain lines and said that that's appropriate to their income. So I want to come back to the issue of trade-offs and the trade-offs that I see families making every day.
Dr. Cutts, could we, in about 1 minute, we've got other testifiers here.
Be happy to.
Thank you.
I see families who are really juggling this in ways that are detrimental to their families, families who can't afford medication, families who don't bring their kids in for health care when they need it, and they're very reasonably juggling off the costs of other things in their lives. This creates a stress. And we use a term now called toxic stress, which we think is really important in people's lives. You know, Kelly Clarkson said, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. I have to say this is not science. The adverse child events program does not say this is true. And children who experience adversity and parents who are experiencing adversity really pay a consequence. That we have sacrificed many children at the altar of what we consider or want to believe is childhood resiliency. And I'm telling you, children pay a price. So I urge you to consider this. I will give you as reference the WIC program, which sets as its cutoff 185% income. And we don't give those people at the higher end half a package. The summer feeding program, which is run through the Department of Education, which does summer feeding programs, which are generally open site, and they qualify if 50% or more of the children are in free or reduced lunch. So I give you those as examples and encourage you to consider this so that we can have schools be hunger-free zones where we are alleviating, not creating, food insecurity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have Rabbi Zimmerman. And good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name, please.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm Rabbi Marcia Zimmerman, the senior rabbi of Temple Israel in Minneapolis, the largest congregation in the state of Minnesota, the 10th largest Reform congregation in the United States. I also am the chairperson of the Minnesota Rabbinical Association, a representation of Jews, the majority of Jews in the state of Minnesota. And I am the chairperson of the Children's Hospital Ethics Committee. And so I come here because children and families are what it's all about in my business, the business of religion. And so my hope is that you listen to what is the reality in our state, and then the religious imperative, the moral imperative, to not allow policy to get in the way of our hopes and dreams for our state. So here we are. Since 2008, people have been walking into my office asking for help for rent and food on a weekly basis. Families who have never had to reach out and ask ever before. The loss of jobs, the realities in their lives of mortgage payments, food. It is unbelievable. A woman had to sell her dining room table to feed her children. These are the stories that are coming into my office. We also help take care of people through Shabbat on Sabbath. The Jewish Sabbath is Friday night and Saturday morning. People are coming to services, which is wonderful, but they're coming because we have food for them after services and before. We have lunch on Shabbat. Every synagogue in this state are feeding people on Saturday afternoon, whose only meal that is for the day. And that is what school lunch is as well for these children, often the only meal they have all day. So here, the problem is a reality. The moral imperative, the religious imperative, is certainly that all children are each of our children, that we are all responsible, as Isaiah 58 says, to clothe the naked and to feed the hungry. That is the moral imperative. We also, the religious community, see ourselves as partners of government. We want to help feed our children. In Judaism, as in every monotheistic tradition, begins with the five books of Moses. And in the five books of Moses, it tells us that we are to eat, to be satiated, and then we bless God. We call it the Birkat Hamazon, the blessing of the food. And after we eat is when we bless God. The blessing before the meal actually came thousands of years later from the rabbis. First and foremost, we are eating and then satiated. And that is what we can do together as partners. I support House File 31 so that we can truly be partners with God and with one another. Thank you.
Rabbi Zimmerman, thank you so much. Anyone else care to testify for House File, for or against House File 31?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Judith Tenenbaum, and I am here on behalf of Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger. We have been working on this issue along with Representative Winkler and Representative Newton because we are very concerned about hunger in Minnesota. Mazon, a Jewish response to hunger, is a national organization making grants to food shelves and other things like Second Harvest around the country. They make 300 grants. Legal Aid is one of their grantees as well. They have started a new project across the country encouraging synagogues and their congregants to become involved in advocacy as well as just food shelves and feeding people. And this project that I'm involved in is the Mazone Advocacy Project in Minnesota, and I'm the co-chair of the project. The purpose of this bill, the way we see it, is not only to prevent hunger among school students, but also to simplify meal program administration. We know that school nutritionists do not want to be bill collectors. They want to be providing healthy, interesting, nutritious food for children. Collecting bills is a very difficult situation for them. We know that children do not want to be seen as part of families who cannot afford to pay. They do not want to be stigmatized, and they do not want to be hungry. So we have been working very hard, along with our representatives, to come up with a bill that would help to solve this program. And we want to encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else would like to testify for or against House File 31? Okay, at this time we have, you should have received a printout of school nutrition programs. And Mr. Strom, did you want to just go over that very quickly and what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, members, the printout is organized by the recipient of the funds, which are school districts for the first 10 pages, and then non-public schools and other providers of nutrition programs for the remaining pages. What's listed in the columns, all except the very end column, are the counts. That is the number of meals served.
Mr. Strom, if you can hold, if the testifiers would remain here, we still have a few questions possibly for testifiers. I'm sorry I didn't mention that, but I'm sorry, Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair,
you continue.
So what's listed across the page are the six categories for which the state funds the or partially funds the breakfast free count, the reduced and full paid breakfast counts, and then the lunch free, reduced, and paid. So those are the number of meals in each of those columns. And then the very last column shows what the impact of House File 31 would be to offer another 40 cents for each reduced priced meal. So it's simply taking that fourth to last column, the reduced lunch column, and providing another 40 cents per meal provided. So that's where the revenue number comes from, is the very last column, but the rest of the columns are number of meals served.
Okay, Mr. Strom, just look at the current aid. Is that the amount of the dollars, or is that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's the amount of the state contribution for those food service programs.
Okay. And then the number of meals is that second line.
Yes.
There. And is that under the House File 31, the $3.5 million, is that the number of meals, or is that the cost?
That's the cost. That should actually have been up a line.
Okay,
that's the cost.
Very good. So that $3.5 should be up a line.
Yeah.
That's the cost. Very good. All right. We're going to go. Representative Ann Selk, you had a question for one of the testifiers earlier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just briefly address the local control issue and the local decision making by local boards of education. First of all, I want to compliment Representative Newton for his legislation and also his testifiers. You know, oftentimes local control in small, rural, poor communities and districts becomes a debate and a discussion about familiarity and community pressures. And it's been my experience that oftentimes the poor are as judgmental of the poor as the wealthy are of the poor. And I've seen local decision making whereby those who speak the loudest and are the organized the most receive the benefit, and those that have no voice don't get the benefits. I've seen decision making that we all would find questionable. And as a supporter of local decision making, I would hope that the committee would come together and recognize that nutrition and the basics of life for youngsters rises pretty pretty high above those other decisions that local boards have to make. So I would really hope that we can come together and unanimously support Representative Newton's bill here.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Newton, I just want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. because as we talk about helping kids to be successful, that comes in many different ways from many different avenues. And this is one of those ways, because we know a hungry child, it's hard for a hungry child to learn. And my hope is that no child should ever be punished for the actions of their parents. And in a large way, that's what we're doing. We are punishing the child for the actions of a parent. Inability to pay or not send 40 cents with the child to the school. And that should not be the burden of the child. So I just wanted to make a comment about that in the hopes that we can create policy here that supports the success of children. So thank you.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have spoken previously this morning in strong support of this bill, but I just wanted to say that I'm extremely proud of my rabbi, Rabbi Zimmerman, for testifying this morning, and for Mazon, a Jewish organization, for bringing this forward. So thank you.
Representative Radinovich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel compelled to speak in favor of this bill as well. While I understand the issue of local control, and I think Representative Enzels did a good job of speaking to that, I think it's within the state's purview to set these guidelines for local districts to follow. I think that this is another one of those debates that gets to the heart of an issue, which is, in my brief, I read that some of the criticism of this bill was centered on the fact that it might allow those parents who would take advantage of the system or allow themselves to become dependent on this. And I think that's a central debate that we've heard over and over the last couple of years, is whether these programs foster dependence or whether they are a key and crucial piece of allowing upward mobility in our schools. And so I think that you know, it's important that we look at this as an opportunity to provide for students, 7 and 8 year olds, who've already been held responsible on a number of different levels for the decisions of their parents. And I don't think that extending that disapproval to this realm is something that we can allow to continue. And I speak in favor of the bill. Thank you.
We have an A2 amendment at the desk here. Does anyone care to move that amendment? It should be in your packets.
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
McDonald.
I'd like to move my amendment.
All right. Representative McDonald moves the H0031A2 amendment. Would you like to talk to your amendment, Representative?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Newton, I'd like to thank you for bringing this to our attention. And it's a very important issue, and the testifiers did a wonderful job in enlightening us and encouraging us to support this bill. It is true, no kid should be turned away. And I am very happy that my school districts are not on the list of turnaway policy. I think that is unacceptable, certainly. And this addresses that. However, I do have some concerns, and I think there's a more efficient way to address this issue, and I'd like to read through the amendment. So
you bet. Please proceed.
So do you want me to go through some of the amendments here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on page 1, line 8, delete A. Page 1, line 9, strike 12 cents and insert 15. Page 1, line 10, strike and insert lunch served to students, 15 cents for each. Now I'm going a wee bit too fast, just let me know. Also delete 52 and insert 21. The next change is page 1, line 11. After lunch, insert served to students.
Okay, Representative McDonald.
And then finally.
Okay.
Page 1, delete lines 12 and 15.
Okay.
Then I'll explain my amendment.
Very good.
The A2 amendment builds upon Representative Newton's trying to accomplish this, House File 31, but takes my approach, my amendment takes a different approach. Where the A2 amendment would strike the 40-cent increase for reduced price meals reimbursements for the new mandate. And with about the same amount of funds required under House File 31, my A2 amendment would increase the reimbursement rates for free and reduced price lunches from 12 cents to 15 cents and increase the rate for reduced prices meals from 12 cents to 21 cents. So with the increased reimbursement rates across the board and with a second increase in the reduced price meals, we better enable schools to cover increasing costs by the changing federal guidelines. Now, the cost of the federal guidelines, the cost of food is rising. Many school districts are forced to increase the prices because of the federal guidelines of healthier meals. So what this, my amendment does, is it spreads the money around to the school districts more appropriately and still addresses the issue of making sure that no kid is left behind or goes hungry.
Representative Newton. Thank you, Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. I don't agree with the amendment. And for one reason is what you would do for children on reduced price, rather than paying $2 a week, they would pay $1.85. If they can't come up with $2, it's very probable they're not going to come up with $1.85. Part of my background is I was a grocer, and that, so I'm used to working with low margins. And when I look at 100 million meals and the 3 cents that you're providing, that's almost the same amount that I've got in my bill. That's roughly 3.3. Representative Hurtas' figures is because he works on low margins also. But it's roughly the same amount of money. And what you're doing is not solving the problem for those children who are on reduced lunch right now. You're spreading the money across all the children who are receiving or who are having school lunches.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, Representative Newton, thank you, but I certainly disagree with you. What my amendment would do is it gives the money necessary for the school districts to ensure that no child is turned away, but it does it in a more responsible manner. There are parents out there that certainly can afford the 40 cents and want to have a skin in the game. And what this opportunity, what my amendment does, gives the money to the school districts and let them decide to ensure that no kid is turned away. So what your bill does is supplants. Mine adds the money necessary for all school districts. So, of course, we can disagree, but I hope that you would see that this is a much better situation for all school districts to ensure and accomplish what your bill is doing, but in a more fair and equitable fashion.
And Representative Newton. Chair, I respectfully do disagree. I think that the money is better appropriated to the school districts for the reduced price lunch.
Representative Van Zyl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, would speak against the amendment. While I think Representative McDonald probably in this amendment provides some assistance and relief and benefit to the district, it certainly takes away from the children. And just think of what we're doing here. We're quibbling about pennies. Pennies for poor children. Representative McDonald, we're going to have lots of opportunity between now and adjournment to talk about real money. Real money affecting real people and taxpayers. Let's not get bogged down about pennies for poor kids. Please vote against this amendment.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And well, I have a couple of questions here. I do support this amendment. And I guess I want to start with a question for you, Representative Newton. You had mentioned that $1.85 per meal for reduced price lunches that parents are paying. I thought federal law was that you couldn't charge more than 40 cents for reduced price lunches. Could you kind of clarify what is the federal law regarding what we can charge for free or reduced price lunches?
Representative Woodard, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Representative Woodard, what I was talking about was the difference, the 40 cents a day difference over a week would be $2 under my bill, and as provided by Representative McDonald, it would amount to $1.85. But if the parents can't come up with $2 a week, and aren't providing that money, it's very doubtful they're going to come up with $1.85.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the clarification. I get it now. You're talking about on a weekly basis, yeah, not on a per meal basis. So the federal law is that 40 cents, you can't charge more than 40 cents per reduced price lunch. The reason I like this approach is that, you know, many of us ran on, let's stop with the mandates that we have heard from our school districts, we've heard from school boards, that, you know, St. Paul is usually well-intentioned. But we like to act as the state school board here and say, this is where you need to spend the money. And I really think that our schools, every school I've been in, I would assume every school everyone here has been in, has the right intentions and want to teach our kids, want to have the nutrition for our kids. It is disappointing some of our school districts have had turn-away policies. I think that's not a good policy and would like to see those school districts change that. But I think for us to come in and tell them we know better than you is just another example of us trying to mandate and tell them how to run their business. And I don't like that approach. And, you know, we talked a little bit about real money. And yesterday we talked about paying back the shift. And we had mentioned that it doesn't cost a lot when our school districts borrow money. That's real money, too. And so, you know, if it costs a school district $11,000 or $12,000, the money we're looking at here isn't that much. You're right, Representative Anzell. $3.5 million is a lot to taxpayers. I guess we can quibble over what real money, the definition of real money is. But, you know, when we talk about even the school shift and the amount of money that our school districts have to pay in interest, that money could go to this as well. And I do think that there are some parents in the reduced price lunch category in 130 to 185% of the poverty level that do want a skin in the game, that want to participate in this process. And I agree that you know, Representative McDonald made the point that that's not really actual real money going to the school districts. It is supplanting what they're already receiving from these families who want to participate in their school lunch program, who want to show that they are parents who can help their kids with school lunch payments. And instead says that we're going to pay for all of those families and supplant what they're already providing. So I think what Representative McDonald does is actually give the money to the school districts to make that determination on where that money should go. If they're struggling making their school district payment or their lunch payments, this additional $3.5 million that you propose would help them do that in all categories. And I just think that's a pretty good approach and a pretty good compromise approach, if you will, between the idea that they need more money for school lunch program and nutrition programs and the concept that, you know, local control is really where we think that this money really should be allocated towards. And so, I mean, I hope you kind of think about it a little bit. And this really isn't a gotcha amendment in any way or anything else. I think we're all trying to get to the same goal. This is just an approach that I think meets all of our goals.
Representative Quan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the testifiers. Some of the comments, especially by you know, the rabbi, you know, the teacher, we learn from your comments. And these last 4 years, you know, we're into the fifth year of difficult times, mm-hmm. and we've had the stigma mentioned. And, you know, frankly, there are a lot of families that had really wonderful incomes, and it's hard for them to, you know, face that they don't have that money to provide as they have for their children. And in some of the districts, there's a stigma about signing up for free and reduced. And I grew up, I took a sack lunch because we, you know, had a farm and we grew some of our own food, and you know, I didn't think about that as a child. But one thing when I got on the school board, when I started coaching kids in youth sports, is I realized that there were families that had need, but they didn't always, because of the stigma, come forward and sign up on the, you know, free and reduced or some of the other programs. And we tried, you know, the teachers, the coaches, the community, and the school board tried helping out those that didn't fit into the programs. Now, you know, there's great intent in the bill. I think there's great intent in the amendment. I don't think either is perfect, and I think because we're holding it over, maybe we can come to a better, you know, closer to perfect solution. But I like allowing, you know, these funds to go to a school district because they know, they see the kids day in, day out, and they might be in the free and reduced, but the family might be in the full lunch because of the stigma or whatever. And if we let the school districts and the people there that see the children have the extra resources instead of putting it to this group or that, then I think we can help the kids that really need it. And I hope that in the medium between now and we do the omnibus, that we can, you know, get past, you know, maybe some of the viewpoints and the stereotypes, because when you're there with the kids around you, stereotypes melt away because they're each individuals. And the toughest part I found when I was on the involved with the Zed Education District is that government programs too often have silos and restrictions, and the kids don't fit in there. And by taking these funds, and it's valid to put these funds forward, but by taking those funds and allowing the people that are there to help most appropriately, that flexibility, I think that does the best for the kids, the community, and, you know, I just hope that we can improve that. So I like the intent of the bill. I like the intent of the amendment. But let us not stop at this one amendment in the effort to try and make this a better bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
I have Representative.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know if it's possible to divide the amendment and vote on the two halves of the amendment. And my suggestion would be to divide the amendment so that we vote on the portion that goes through line 1-11, and then the portion that goes from lines 112 to 114, voting first on lines 112 through 114, because it effectively eliminates the kids on the reduced price meals.
To the division, Representative Dabney?
To rephrase Representative Newton's in the form of a question, can the amendment be divided between lines 1.6 and 1.7? I believe that section would then stand alone.
Yeah. Mr. Strom? Division between 1.6 and 1.7?
Mr. Chair, as I understand Representative Newton's issue on the division, he'd like to vote on the paragraph B separately from the rest of the amendment. The amendment does two things. It changes the rates, but it also eliminates the language in paragraph B. And I think in my view of that, that would be divisible there, that you could have the new language with or without any change in the rates. So one could require that reduced price meals come for free or not, and but the rates would still be set separately.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what Mr. McDonald, Representative McDonald, is trying to do here, but I think it is a little unusual for us to be considering what is obviously a controversial amendment to a bill that's being laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. This is certainly a conversation we could have if the chair and the committee do decide eventually to include this in the omnibus bill, and it would save us some time now and maybe let us all, as Representative Quam suggested, might be a good idea to go back and sit down and talk this one through outside of the committee and think about what we really want to do. Like I said, we may not even include this in the omnibus bill. We don't know. We don't know where we're going from here. So I would request that perhaps Mr. McDonald, Representative McDonald, if he could withdraw his amendment, we could do exactly what I think Representative Quam was suggesting.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yeah, advice. I don't know that that's a bad idea, Representative Morgan. I would just point out that, you know, what we've talked about on the House floor ad nauseum is that the work that needs to be done in committee and not on the floor. And so I don't think that's bad advice for us to, if we think, you know, and I think Representative Newton, I believe the intent that you have there is kind of what we're trying to get at as well. And so I think, but we would know that if we were able to have that conversation maybe outside of committee. So my advice is that, you know, while I think we need to get our work done in committee, not a bad idea if Representative Newton's open to having this discussion outside of this committee and we can work on it from there. I don't think there's any objection to doing that.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think if Representative Newton would be willing to work together with us, certainly I could withdraw the amendment. My amendment increases funding to the schools. So, Representative Anzels, you talked about local control and how important that is. This is what the amendment does. It gives local control to the schools, and it increases the funding for schools necessary to ensure that no kid is hungry. So it has great merit, but because we have this political divide, you're suspect of my amendment, and certainly that's as if, you know, that's possible, true. But it does not do that. It helps it immensely. So if you'd be willing to work together with me, I'd be willing to withdraw the amendment, and we'll work together on it to form a more efficient bill.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McDonald. Yes, I'm more than willing to work with you, and I don't think there's a political divide. I'm hoping there's not. I think, if I understand, you know, I'd like to go forward with my bill too, and have that move forward as it is, and then we can work from there. But if you're looking at providing an additional 3 cents per meal across the board for all students, I think that's great. I'm sure our nutritionists would be more than happy with that, given the new federal guidelines on, you know, having additional vegetables and fruits, and it would give the nutritionists a greater choice of meals and more to offer for the schools. So, given that, if you do withdraw your amendment, I'd like to move forward and ask that we vote on my bill and. And I would certainly support working with you, Representative McDonald.
Okay, yeah, we won't be voting on the bill. The bill will be laid over. And as chair, I will guarantee if Representative McDonald wants to withdraw the motion that we will get the stakeholders together prior to any omnibus bill coming forward on this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, certainly that I think that is something that we can work out. It certainly doesn't. My intention then, Representative Newton, isn't to increase it and then still add your bill as well. I'd like to work together with that. The two wouldn't go in hand. So why don't we work together on this, and yep. I'll withdraw the motion.
Thank you. Representative McDonald withdraws the H0031A2 amendment, and thank you very much. Representative Newton, any closing 10 seconds?
No, Mr. Chair, I just renew my motion to move forward with House File 31. Thank you.
All right, House File 31 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you. The next bill on the agenda, House File 364. Representative Bly, welcome to the Education Finance Committee. And do we have someone that would move House File 364 for Representative Dabney moves House File 364 for possible, lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Mark Fortin. This bill I bring before you has, I think, a couple of intentions in it, and I want to say that we're kind of piggybacking in a way on a testimony that you heard last week from alternative school students and teachers, and I hope that's still fresh in your memory. I have a testifier with me who has a lot of history with these kinds of programs and a lot of knowledge about where they've been. The two issues that I'm trying to address with this bill, one is that in the years of austerity with education, we saw a cutback in the funding that the programs that I'm representing, the alternative programs and area learning centers, There was a provision that allowed for 1.5 funding, extended time funding for programs like this. It was cut to 1.2, and there was talk of even cutting it completely. And just as a little story about how this cut affected my own program in Northfield, one of the principles of an alternative program, and as we get started, is to try to meet the students who have this need of a different kind of path where they are, to look at their needs and really kind of construct an educational program around them, around what their needs are. And that oftentimes includes being able to meet with them outside of the school day or at a different time during the school day, and allows them to perhaps have a job or to attend a regular school and come to make up credits that were lost in the past in our program. And so it allowed us to do a lot of different things. At the heyday of the program that I worked in, I would have people stop me in the supermarket and say, "You know, it's so wonderful that your program is working for our students. It's too bad that not every student has a choice to come to your school." And I'm not advocating for that, but I just wanted to say that, you know, we had a building that we were part of the community. We made great efforts to reach out to the community, and we had lots of connections. After that cut to 1.2, and part of the reason that the cut affected us drastically is that we still tried to provide the need to students even though we were not being funded for it. There were students who needed that extra time, and our program tried to continue to, which is true of many programs across the state, tried to provide and meet the need of the student. It meant that when a new administrator came into our district and he looked at things, he decided that our program needed to be cut back, that we couldn't provide those kinds of programs. We went from a very innovative program that met students where they are to becoming a more traditional kind of high school in a different building program. In my opinion, that hurt our ability to really meet the needs of these students who, as I think you heard the other day, have a variety of issues and problems that they face that they didn't plan for, or but they have affected them and put them in a situation which affects their schooling, their ability to be successful in school. Our programs started intervening and helping these students in the 1970s, and since then we've learned lots of good ways of helping these students, and it's been a challenge to meet their needs under these new restrictions in funding. One of the things that we also did in my district and in other districts when we made the argument that if we could reach these students at an earlier age, it would be better for them. They might not need this kind of programming later on, and that was resulted in targeted services, which provided for programs for K through 8 students who could have a summer school program, have an after school program, sometimes have a before school program, or they'd also get some breakfast to start a good school day. So there are a lot of programs that in some ways met the needs of students you already heard about in the previous bill. There are needs out there that need to be met. They're not going away, and we need to make sure that we provide for them. So as I said, the first part of my bill is to reinstate some of that funding that was lost to try to preserve these programs. And the other is that a concern about the proposal in the department's proposal for funding to roll over this extended funding into another kind of funding that would really put the decision-making into school boards and administrators to decide where that money ought to go. As I personally have seen, districts have lots of needs they need to meet, and if the money doesn't continue to follow the students and the students don't have the choice to choose these kinds of programs, that will make those programs disappear. Just to tell that little story, and maybe you can ask me some more questions about it later on, but I have with me Wayne Jennings, who is a longtime worker in these kinds of students, started the St. Paul Open School many years ago, and I'd like to turn it over to Wayne.
Mr. Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Wayne Jennings. I've been in education for about 60 years, and about half of that time was spent working with programs for at-risk students because I knew, as we all know, all students have to succeed in school to be prepared for life. And we have students who haven't succeeded in school, and something has to be done about them. They didn't succeed because of maybe family issues, maybe their own mistakes, etc. But at any rate, these programs help to bring those students to graduation and to develop the competencies they're going to need. 2 years ago, the legislative auditor reviewed the alternative education programs in Minnesota, particularly the area learning centers, and came out with a favorable report. I'll just read one line from their summary. We found that elementary and middle schools who attend extended time alternative education programs, such as before or after school programs or summer school, showed higher than expected growth on two standardized assessments when compared with other students and national norms. So these that we're talking about programs that the legislative auditor found works. That was report came out in February of 2010.
I might say that I think you all got a copy of a summary of that report in your packets last week. Is that right? Okay, so you hopefully you saw that in the testimony that came forward at the time.
Hey, any questions here for testifier or Representative Bly on House File 364? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bly, I'm a big fan of Arizona's it's now called School Plus program. It started as Kindergarten Plus, where they provide additional funding for at-risk students, air quotes, at-risk students, to provide additional days. Initially, it was 20 days before school started and 20 days additional after for kindergarten to give extended time to those low-income, often ELL students, and then they've increasingly expanded it, not just kindergarten, but K-3. Have you considered in this proposal, since I think we've pretty good consensus that those early years in building a strong base is key for future learning and even for high school graduation, graduating the, instead of going straight to 1.5, I'm providing additional fund, greater additional funding at earlier ages to incent school districts to look at opportunities to provide extended time at those early grades that we're increasingly recognizing are so critical.
Well, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Dabney, really a lot of the choices right now with the funding are made by local districts in the sense that they develop the programs that will meet the needs of students. So I don't think that under having the funding there would preclude or prevent a district from having a program like that if educators or others came forward and said this is what we want to do with that targeted services money. And I think there are probably programs out there that do similar things to that already. So I don't know if there's any real need, unless you wanted to specifically say they should have a program like that. I don't think there's a need to do that. But I think that's certainly a good idea.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. This is a question for Mr. Strom. When we made this law change or this program change in 2004, what amount did we then, I'll say, save compared to what Representative Bly is requesting now? Because he's requesting $33 million, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, prior to the extended time formula being created, the additional pupil weight counted as part of the regular pupil weighting. So I'll have to go back and see if we can get an estimate of that. But it showed up in the pupil's regular weighting instead of the kid counting as 1.0 pupils in average daily membership. It was run through all the programs in the pupil weighting. So I'll see if I can get a number for the number of hours from that year. But because it was run into the waiting, I'm not sure if I can or not.
Oh, yes. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Strom, it's not that important. I was just curious because I remember when we debated this before and reduced that. And I, too, am a strong supporter of alternative programs. However, always concerned that we have a movement toward proficiency in those programs, just as we have movement toward proficiency in our regular education program. So that was always the issue that I was very high on with my alternative students, is that this is not, this is alternative, but this is still working toward proficiency. In my instance, it was in English and language arts and reading and writing. So Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bly, thanks for bringing this bill forward. I just met with one of my school districts last night, and they have a celebration school within their school district, which is based on Title I schools and growth. And they really, this was probably one of their number one priorities was the importance of extended day and how that really helps to add value and the growth in students. And anything we can do to enhance things that help close the achievement gap is very important. And so I'm just letting you know my support of this bill and helping students be successful. Thanks.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe you have this on the agenda coming up, but I think it's almost impossible to evaluate this proposal outside of the context of clearly understanding why it is that the governor's budget recommends rolling in the extended day funding, because I think that's done in a very large context of evaluating what the responsibility is of the district as a whole to at-risk students and whether we're letting districts off the hook with alternative learning programs in the sense that they don't have to be as flexible and adaptable in their mainstream program because they can move students into the alternative learning. And I'm not arguing for that one way or the other, but I know the department has a lot of data analysis behind this recommendation and the governor's proposal. And so I find it very hard, as sympathetic as I am to the mission of alternative learning centers, to support this without a further understanding of the department's position.
Representative Reinert, save that question. Next Tuesday, we will be, we'll have the governor's bill. We'll be going over the governor's bill next Tuesday. Representative Lai, you have a...
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. If I could just make a couple of comments. First of all, in the high school programs, the way that this 1.5 funding is allocated, it's not, you know, because our funding is based on the success of students, unlike any other school program in the state, our programs only get funded for the success that students do, that they have. So it is possible that that 1.5, although it sits there, may not entirely be used by a district for each student. You know, a student who could begin that might not use the whole amount. But I think I have made that very statement myself as a director of an alternative program that I hoped that districts would recognize they needed to make innovations themselves and to meet the needs of these students. However, over the years, I've learned, and through the process of seeing my program go what I would call backward in its ability to meet the needs of these students, is that it's incredibly difficult within the confines of a district to have something innovative within the program, or even to have, unless we're going to reform the whole system, which I think is a much bigger issue. It's a real struggle if you don't have some autonomy to pull away and say, we're going to have this program that truly meets the needs of the students where they are and can develop a program around their needs, which are unique and different, not only among students, but from community to community. And that's one reason why if you visited alternative programs across the state, you'd see they're all different because they really evolve based on what that community is like. And they're all different because they really evolve based on what that community is like and what those community needs are like. So although I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, I'm cautious because of my experience of what I see happening, that it's incredibly difficult to not be persuaded by the weight of what exists already in the system.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to hide my notes a little bit better now because Representative Reinert, I think, went down the road I wanted to take, so I am moving a little farther away from you. But just as a quick follow-up to that, just a statement first and then a quick question. One is I appreciate some of your comments today. One, money following the student and choice and empowerment. And I've got a couple of bills that I'll come and talk to you about that follows that same line, maybe to an extent a little farther than you're looking for, Representative Bly. But I agree with that. I think that is exactly the route we ought to take as we look at funding. But do you have, and you may have answered this question fairly well already, but you know, how would this interact with what the governor's doing? Is it an either or? I mean, where the governor's rolling this into compensatory revenue, would what you're asking to do be on top of that, or how would it interact with what the governor's budget's doing now?
Well, Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt and Representative Woodard. The honest question is I don't know. Part of, well, when I asked questions of the representative for the department at our policy meeting, her answer was, well, we thought it was important to have this discussion. So here's my bill. Let's have the discussion. So I hope to learn. And really, you know, as I said, the second purpose is because this is happening, I want to make sure that we preserve these programs, that they are there, that they exist for the students who need them. I believe in because I've worked in them and I know what they're like, that they do really good service, excellent service for these students. And the other challenge that we've faced over the years is the very content-based, basic skills kinds of testing, high-stakes testings that we've had to do with. The basic skills test back in when they were in eighth grade were actually helpful. I think they became a target for our students to aim at, and they could get to that proficiency that you're talking about. But as we've gone forward, our schools get coded as failing schools because our students are failing. Well, they came to us in that condition, and we've been working with them, and as Wayne Jennings pointed out, we have helped them grow more than any other setting that they may have been in, and yet we get coded as failing schools. So if we're going to overcome that, we need to look at, and I do have a bill that addresses this, looking at other kinds of measurements of the success of schools. And so I'm hoping that we can have that discussion too.
Representative Mariani.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably want to channel a little bit of former Chair Erickson and my two note-sharing colleagues at the end of the table here. You know, we heard, and this is not just, you know, leveled at you, Representative Wise, so please. You know, we hear a lot of language, excuse me, in committee about, you know, gee, I hope districts will do this. It'd be my desire that school districts do this. And I'm constantly reminded, you know, that the responsibility for providing a quality education to our young people in the state rests with us. It rests with the state. Our independent school districts and everything else they create are things that we allow to happen. But the responsibility lies with us. And so there's constantly a compelling state interest that's before us. And every issue that comes before us when it comes to the education of our kids. And so, you know, I'm just looking, Representative Bly, and I am empathetic with this, but just a couple of quick questions. ALCs are creatures of school districts, and am I correct?
Representative Bly.
Alternative programs are, you could say, are creatures of school districts. Area learning centers are somewhat different. Some are. Some have an independence or autonomy where they work with several districts and have to have negotiations with those various districts to meet, you know, their requirements or whatever. So it may well be that kind of autonomy for an area learning center may go away if this changes.
Representative Mariani.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, it's too long for this committee, but what I'm getting at is where the accountability lines fall here. High school graduation rates, and here's where I'm sympathetic, that I think the student population here are precisely students that are in these different learning environments because they haven't been on track, you know, toward, you know, success against their standards and graduation expectations, and we can talk about all the reasons, you know, for that. But the point is to create a place where we can not give up on them and continue to provide movement for them. And I do think that there's something unfair about a dominant assessment system that holds these learning environments accountable independent of the fact that these students come out of a prior experience. And so high school graduation rates, for instance, then become the responsibility of these learning communities, not the districts from which they emanate from. Am I correct on that?
Representative Bly.
Yes, I believe that's the case. Yes.
Right. And so, you know, Mr. Chair, one of the things I'm concerned about is making sure that, you know, we have a close loop around accountability here And that's sort of a polite way of saying that, you know, what I don't want us to do is to encourage policy that basically allows those creatures that we create in the state to carry out our most important function, that we don't allow them to just sort of slough off and dump, if you will, students on somewhere else. You know, our education system needs to work, period. And all that by just sort of a tough message about our need. And Mr. Chair, you started with this theme at the beginning of the year, you know, having outcomes-based, measurable results tied to our decisions here. And so, Representative Bly, you know, looking at the legislative auditor, I think they made a couple of observations. One is that we don't have the high school graduation rates or, MCA results, generally speaking, across this community that meets our needs as a state. I understand the reasons why that is. But the auditor then also says that one of the things we should be working on is different measures for performance, but obviously still held to high standards. And so as we move forward with this, I would encourage that we not move forward with any kind of change unless we're building in language to those changes along the recommendations of the legislative auditor. And that gets us to the outcomes-based result type of, you know, direction that we all say that we want to be about. And I know it's tough work. I also know last time you were here, you had a pretty good bill that got us at this. And I would encourage, again, any kind of movement. And this isn't the policy committee we're dealing with what is right now. I get it. But I would be hesitant, along with Representative Breiner and Representative Erickson, to do any kind of change, including a governor's change, frankly, unless we are weighing in very aggressively and assertively around our clear expectations in terms of student results that are different than what we currently have and build on top of that.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask, is there anyone here that would like to testify for or against House File 364? Okay. Representative Bly, your final comment.
Okay. To thank you, Chair Marquardt, and to Representative Mariani. I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. I think that's probably true. One caution I have is even using the bar of getting everyone to graduate from high school is perhaps, I mean, it needs some unfolding, and we need to look at it a little more carefully. Sometimes there are times when I've counseled students who come to my program who are so far behind that actually getting a high school diploma may not be the answer for them, and to guide them into another way that they can go on to higher education perhaps or something else and help them meet that goal in some fashion. So that student may not end up with a high school diploma, but they're still going to make progress and go forward in their life. And so I think it's hard without really understanding all of the ins and outs of that to make sure how that's going to work. But the other thing I wanted to mention is that
Representative Bly, you've got 30 seconds.
Okay. Sorry. There's another way that we've had this particular cut is an example of other ways that we've been clipped back and what we could do. There was a time when we could work with a student up to the age of 25 and get them to that diploma. That's disappeared and gone away. So we have a shortened time period to work with them.
Point well taken.
At any rate, I hope that you will consider this effort to reinstate some funding that we lost that did hurt our programs, made it more difficult for us. And as we look at refunding or funding adequately our education system, we also look at funding adequately these kinds of programs.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jennings, thank you for being here today. And Representative Bly, thank you. I will lay over House File 364 for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. Okay, we have a few minutes, and we'd like to get started with the Minnesota Department of Education report. We have Deputy Commissioner Montano here. And we'll get going, and then we will come back at a later date. And Mr. McHenry, welcome. If you could introduce yourself for the committee, and please proceed. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jesse Montano. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Education. To my right here, bringing up the PowerPoint, is Kevin McHenry, who is our Government Relations Director. Before I start, I would like everybody to take their pen or pencil, go to slide 7. I must have looked at this numerous times and just caught it this morning, where I have fiscal year 2013 agency. If you could please take your pen, pencil, where it says 63 are state-funded, cross-state, and put federal. And where it says 37% are federally funded, cross out federally and put state.
So, members, that's 63% federally funded, 37% state funded. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a major error. And as I said, I reviewed this numerous times, and I can't believe I just caught it this morning. Thank you for the opportunity to provide you with an overview of the Department of Education. For many of you, you know that I have been around for quite some time, so I had the opportunity to work through numerous commissioners and numerous trends and so forth. So it's my pleasure to give you an overview today in terms of my perspective and where we've come and where the department is headed. Because I have been around the block a few times with respect to working at a state education agency, I can tell you that initially our role was a lot of mostly dealing with passing funding through, dealing with compliance, and so forth. That has historically, you know, been our role, is to administer federal programs, state programs. But as accountability becomes more and more important and we start looking at more and more accountability, the role that the SEA, state educational agencies, play is becoming more one where we are leading improvement efforts and developing coherent systems of support to help schools move towards achievement for all students. Okay, he's trying. That brings us to slide 3. Just a few facts and information about the department. We serve over 850 K-12 students, their families. About 118,000 young children participate in a variety of early learning programs. 82 adult learners participating in adult education programs, including GED and citizen programs. 339 school districts and 148 charter schools. And over 52,000 licensed teachers. The mission for the department, and this is something that the commissioner feels very strongly about, is leading for educational excellence and equity every day for everyone. And that is something we keep in mind on a regular basis as we look at programs and so forth. What does this mission mean for the agency? Almost there, okay. Slide 5. For the agency, for the staff, and this is something that has been ingrained in staff, one of the things that we did initially in the department is start looking at cross-agency teams that were working on similar initiatives. And as they proceed with their work, these are the factors that they keep in mind. One, ensuring that all Minnesota students receive a high-quality education that prepares them for success in college and career. Being an innovative education agency that serves students, parents, teachers, administrators, schools, and districts by providing exemplary guidance, technical support, and assistance. And finally, by providing every learner with access to a high-quality education that promotes his or her development to full potential through an outstanding nation-leading educational system. And again, these are things we keep in mind. Early on, the department, as they started looking at the functions and the programs that we administer and implement, we began looking at the governor's 7-point plan. I won't go into that. I think many of you have heard his 7-point plan numerous times. And so we started looking at what are the initiatives that we do in the department that feed into the 7-point plan, keeping, again, our mission in mind, guiding principles that lead our work, which is to identify priorities aligned with the mission and the 7-point plan, ensure measurable outcomes that drive the work and keep us on the path to success. I'll talk a little bit later about the fact that the department is data-rich and information-poor, and that is one of the priorities and focuses of the commissioner, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Deputy Commissioner Montano, our time is up today.
Oh, yeah, just starting.
You're just ready to get going. We just got the PowerPoint up, Mr. McHenry, and we're going to have to call her for the day. Can you come back at another date, please?
I would be delighted to.
Very, and I apologize for that. So thank you, and members, we are adjourned.